speaker is John Grohol. I'm really delighted to introduce him to you. For those who don't know John, Dr. Grohol is a pioneer in the use of internet in mental health. In 1995, pretty much before every one of us, he created the psychcentral.com website, which he still leads today. His site has been named one of the 50 best websites in 2008 by the magazine Time, or time.com. And the title of his talk today will be From Netscape to Twitter, 15 Years of Mental Health Online. John?
Fantastic. Well, welcome. It's good to be here. Like the radio, television, and the telephone before it, the internet has really brought fundamental changes to our society. How we learn, how we socialize, and has fundamentally changed the way we communicate. So it's my pleasure to be here today and review with you some of the past 15 years online. Happy to do that. Let's get started here. Disclosure, yes, I make my living from the internet. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. I certainly, when I got started in psychology, I was planning to be a therapist and not an online entrepreneur. So just think of me like Google, except minus about 20,000 employees. This is our agenda for today. What I'm going to do is to walk through the major time periods of the past 15 years. Obviously, I can't cover everything that's happened in mental health and psychology online in 40 minutes, and I wouldn't try to do so because there's been just so much activity and innovation in the past 15 years. But my interest is really in mental health and bringing psychology and mental health to consumers. So my focus obviously has been psychoeducational resources and that sort of thing on the internet. And for better or for worse, that's a lot of what I'm going to focus on for my presentation. I apologize if you're looking for a more research-centric point of view or whatnot. I have a very consumer-centric point of view. So I dug up a February 1994 newsgroup posting from the newsgroup Alt Support Depression, which was a popular forum before the web for discussion of people looking for help for depression. And this was a very typical posting of the group at the time. Someone comes into the group and says, hey, you know, what's this thing called depression? Where can I go to learn more information about it? I mean, this is where we were 15 years ago, some simple text on a screen. And the story of mental health really starts pre-web. I mean, if you can even imagine that there, of course, was an internet before the World Wide Web, and that it was a vibrant, very wonderful place, really. It just wasn't very user-friendly. So what you found back pre-web was peer-led support groups in things like news groups, mailing lists, and on commercial providers like CompuServes and other networks across the world. News groups were the equivalent of today's web-based forums, as I mentioned. Mailing lists, still very popular, electronic mailing lists for professional discussions as well as consumer support groups. In the United States, we had what we called the big three commercial providers. They were CompuServe, Prodigy, and America Online, and only really one of those exists today in a very similar format. The information was out there in 1994. It just was really hard to find and access, and it was just not very user-friendly, so most people didn't know it was available through a CompuServe or a AOL or something like that. And that brings us to the Netscape era, which I called it, and we had the onset of people's personal home pages, things like Andrew's Depression Page. That's a copy from 1997. The innovation with the web wasn't just its invention. Lots of technologies get invented every year, and no one uses them. The real innovation with the web was that it was invented, and then someone actually wrote some software that made use of it in a very user-friendly fashion. And of course, that was Mosaic, which then became Netscape. And this sounds absurd, but at the time, it was absolutely fascinating that you could download text with graphics attached to it in line at the same time. And that was the big innovation of the day. We wouldn't have the web we have today, this interactive web 2.0 thing, if it weren't for those initial innovations. Keeping in mind, too, that pages look like this, with very text-heavy and maybe a few graphics here and there, because everybody was still using dial-up modems, you know, 14K modems, so things like graphics and stuff took forever to download. So, you know, the key of the Netscape era is that information is power. The more you learn, the more you know, the more you can actually act on that information. Simple things like, you know, what are the common symptoms of depression? Who had that information in 1994? Well, surprisingly, of course, you can go to a library and look it up in a book or something. People didn't even know you could do that. You could call your local mental health association, and they can send you a brochure about it. Or you could go to your family physician and talk to your doctor and say, ooh, you know, I'm feeling kind of down, you know, can you give me something for this? So the web really was the great equalizer of information. Suddenly, you know, Joe Smith, sitting in his house or a computer terminal in a college campus, could learn about the symptoms of depression. They didn't have to go through a gatekeeper, such as a mental health professional or a doctor. So how did the web do this? This error, we're kind of going in chronological order, but there's some overlap and some things are not quite in place. I kind of put this in the 1995 to 2001 timeframe. This basically was 6 years. And it was really characterized by these informational and educational web pages that anyone could put up and publish. And that was the wonderful thing about the web, is that you didn't need to be a huge, you know, CNN or America Online or something. You could be anyone, and you, just like today, and we take this for granted, but you could publish a web page back in 1995-96 on a service like GeoCities, which Yahoo just shut down, and have, you know, hundreds or thousands of visitors, and that would be fantastic. It was publishing by anyone, one to many. And the reason this actually all came about, was because in April 1995, the federal government in the U.S. Defunded the last government internet backbone. And once they stopped funding the last government internet backbone, that actually allowed the other commercial backbones to take its place, and suddenly you could do commercial things on the internet. Before then, commercial activity was frowned upon and was basically forbidden. So I mentioned the key to the web's power was really that anyone could become a publisher and have hundreds or thousands of people read your page. Not fancy, not graphical, but it was still information, and that was the key. It's still largely a one-way conversation. You put the information out there, and people come and read it, and that was it. They didn't really write back. There was no blog or whatnot. And the other very important aspect of early internet information and the web and everything was that, unlike going to your doctor or even going to the library and checking out a book, you could read about anything on the internet anonymously. You could do so in the privacy of your own home, and you did not have to worry about the stigmatization of being labeled, oh, I have depression, or I have schizophrenia, or I have this or that or the other thing. And so it allowed people to explore these things without feeling self-conscious in doing so. And of course, we started to see the rise of things like support groups on the web, which, again, had existed already for many, many years on these private mailing lists and whatnot. But when they transitioned and moved more to the web, you had more visibility, and therefore the support groups became more accessible. Also, I don't have a slide for this, but I thought this was also a very important dimension that in 1995, a group of people got together in Switzerland, and what came from that meeting was the all-important Hahn Code, which actually came out in 1996. And that was eight principles for sort of vetting health information online. And it's been around since that time, and you can go and listen to the presentation about the Hahn Code, which has been a very valuable sort of minimum qualification. So I thought it was interesting to dig up some old statistics from the 1999 time frame to note the fleeting nature of online attention and how we're all like, ooh, you know, Facebook and Twitter, and it's like, well, okay, here we were 10 years ago, just 10 years ago, which is like, you know, nothing in our ordinary lives, but forever in internet time. Look on the left-hand column. What website is missing from the left-hand column? Where's Google? Well, Google wasn't even popular back in 1999. It had just gotten its start and really didn't become popular until about 2000, 2001. So just, you know, Google, the company that is so huge and powerful and can do no wrong today, wasn't really even a player 10 years ago and wasn't even on anyone's radar screen. Trust me, if Yahoo knew how bad Google was going to make their lives, they may have played their cards a little bit differently. The other interesting thing to note here on the right-hand side is the rise of these commercial online health providers like DrCoop.com and OnHealth and whatnot. And as quickly as they go up, they quickly go down too, because there is no DrCoop.com anymore per se. It's sort of a shell company there. OnHealth, again, not really a player. If we look at the numbers for today, you'll see the significant changes. Now, instead of Yahoo being the top in 10 years ago with 30 million visitors a month, now we have Google being on top with 150 million visitors a month. And health is still pretty well represented. Back 10 years ago, only 3 million people were visiting places like the health websites like DrCoop.com. And now Every Day Health and WebMD each get about 22 million visitors a month, which is not too shabby. So I thought it also interesting to talk about about some of the early interventions that were being done on the internet. You may have heard of the Samaritans. They're a charity based in the UK, began in 1953. In 1994, they set up their first email address to specifically answer emails of people who are suicidal. They're really focused on helping people who are in crisis mode and suicidal. And the email service today answers over 60,000 queries. People can just email into this one address, and they get a response back from a trained Samaritan volunteer. Samaritans in 2007, as you see there, had 137,000 email responses. And also notice that 86,000 responses by mobile cell phone, SMS. It's just amazing. And just to give you some iota of how, even though those numbers are so huge, they still only represent 5% of the interactions that the Samaritans do. 90% of their interactions are still by regular telephone. To give you some, I mean, just concept of how many people are in need of that kind of crisis intervention around the world. So another kind of online intervention that certainly online mental health world has experienced is the rise of e-therapy or online counseling. These actually started back in 1995 with some psychologists who thought, wow, you know, I bet I could, like, you know, see a patient through email. And so they did. And you can actually listen to the talk about these online counseling interventions and legal and ethical ramifications in this conference. There'll be a lot more discussion about that. And so email is really the primary way that these online therapeutic interventions were being done, but they were also being done by chat a little bit, some video conferencing, which is also called distance therapy, especially for rural areas or areas that aren't traditionally served or don't have a lot of access to mental health providers. There were a lot of projects in the early and in the mid to late 1990s about these kinds of to offer these mental health services to people that ordinarily wouldn't have access to them. And of course, as e-therapy has progressed in the years, it's branched out into instant messaging and Twitter and Second Life. So it continues to embrace all those different modalities as they come on. We have online clinics now. We have entire, you know, websites that vet and make sure that the professionals offering the services are, you know, licensed and registered to provide mental health services. And I guess I also wanted to mention, of course, the International Society for Mental Health Online, which got started in 1997. And one of the things it did was in 2000, it issued a set of e-therapy guidelines for professionals. And a lot of professional organizations have issued some ethical guidelines or set of guidelines, practice guidelines, for how to do online therapy in a ethical and appropriate manner. So the International Society for Mental Health also has brochures here at the conference that you, if you're interested in learning more about. They're much broader than just e-therapy. I only mention them here because I don't have a slide for them. But they also talk about probably more clinician heavy, but also talk about mental health in general online. Another example of a suicide intervention website, again, to sort of show you the power of a single internet page on the internet since 1995. It's black. I know you can't really read it, but it's called Suicide, Read This First, and it was written by Martha Ainsworth back in 1995. And it's been viewed 8 million times. We started running a survey on it about a year ago. We've had 43,000 respondents to the survey. And of those 43,000, 29% said that this single page has helped them in terms of making the decision not to commit suicide. 24% did not help, and 31% not sure. So if you extrapolate those numbers, a single web page on the internet has saved or helped people choose not to end their lives for 2 million people. And this is some of the feedback that a page like this gets. Certainly we get a lot of negative feedback for it too, and I just wanted to share some of the positive ones. But I mean, the key is that, especially for a suicide type of intervention, a crisis intervention on the internet, is that people need hope. They need to understand that there is the possibility of a tomorrow. And so you get feedback that says, look, I read your page and it gave me hope and that's all I needed. It's amazing that something as simple as a few words on a computer screen can be so powerful. And that while Web 2.0 technologies and stuff, which I love, are very interesting and very powerful in their own right, and I'll talk about those in a few minutes, that a static web page designed and built in 1995, you know, 14 years ago, is still doing a lot more work than a lot of very complicated applications. So. You'll also hear in the conference over the next day or two about some psychoeducational types of online interventions. And these actually also got started a long, long time ago. In the 1980s, there was a psychiatrist by the name of Roger Gold, and he wrote a piece of software called the Therapeutic Learning Program. And it was a very... it was based upon cognitive behavioral techniques, and it was a very complicated and useful program. He did research on it and showed that people who used the program actually benefited from it, much like they would benefit from actual cognitive behavioral therapy. But of course, no one bought it. You know, he tried selling it to professionals, and professionals didn't want something that competed with their therapy. I mean, you know, and consumers didn't know what to make of it. He's turned it into something called Mastering My Life now, and it's based upon the same principles of that original program. But just to show you that you can sort of try and reuse perfectly good and sound theoretical and real cognitive behavioral interventions and put them on the web and make them more widely available to a larger audience. Of course, also, you can't think about an online intervention without mentioning Mood Gym, which is from the Australian University's Mental Health Center for Research. I'm sure I screwed that up. That was released in 2004 and also has some really good research that shows that it's a positive intervention. You'll be hearing more about that later in the conference. These are really wonderful interventions, but the challenge that you find in the research and in the programs themselves is that people don't complete them, is that they look really good on paper, but the hardest thing is to get people to actually go through with the whole 10 sessions or 12 sessions or whatever it is. But the research also shows that all you may need is a couple of sessions for a person to actually have and receive some therapeutic benefits from these kinds of programs. So maybe you don't need all 10 sessions, which is fine. Of course, we couldn't be moving along in this time frame without mentioning blogs. And blogs is short for weblogs. It's a way of publishing information that allows for basically two-way conversation, that you can put an article or your thoughts out there, but you can also get comments and feedback about that article or thoughts. So you have blogs as analysis, a commentary talking about the news of the day, research findings like Cognitive Daily, which blogs every day about a finding in psychology research and cognitive psychology research, Or you could have blogs as journaling, and journaling as a form of blogging has been around since LiveJournal, which took off in the late 1990s, and it was very popular with many people to do the same kinds of things that people do in therapy when journaling, which is expressing their thoughts, trying to get some perspective and context for those thoughts and feelings. But the wonderful thing about blogs is that you're not just talking to yourself at that point. You're actually talking to a small audience. And whether the audience is 5 people or 50 people or 5,000 people, it doesn't really matter. Because if your friends found out about it because you told them, they could give you feedback about, you know, what's going on in your life. Oh, you had a horrible date, you know. Well, maybe you shouldn't be dating losers, you know. So it's that kind of continuous feedback loop, which actually can be very therapeutic and beneficial for people. And you can't talk about blogs, I think, without mentioning a little bit about, and this also comes up in support groups, the increased disinhibition effect online, which is when people communicate online, they do tend to do so in a more disinhibited fashion. So people can express themselves more openly. Now, whether that's a good or bad thing, if they start writing about their problems with their job or something, I mean, that's the learning curve that we've all been on as people learn that, hey, if you want to, you know, actually write about your boss, you might have to put up with the consequences of your boss finding out about it. So, and of course, I had mentioned earlier web support groups. They're growing so much more now because they're on the web, they're accessible, they're being indexed by search engines like Google. And so, you know, millions more people are using them today than they were ever using them before the web. Today, 12% of Internet health users participate in an online support group, according to Pew Internet and American Life Project. And that number jumps. It doubles to 23% of Internet users under 30. So that just goes to show you this divide between the generations that younger people, of course, embrace all these technologies so much more. And then everything came crashing down. So in the 2001-2000 timeframe, all that commercial innovation that was going on the Internet, boom, you know, went away. It wiped out $5 trillion in market value of technology companies like that. I know, because I was in one of those companies. And worthless stock options. And it took out some of the hype around the Internet. You know, sometimes that's probably a good thing, because even today we're seeing that build back up, you know, where Google releases something and everybody just talks about it for the next week if you're in a technology circle or something. It's just, there's still a lot of, if you mention the words Web 2.0 to an investor, they're like, ooh, yes, I'll invest, you know, so you're still getting a bit of that even in today's marketplace. People have very short memories, even though that only occurred 8-9 years ago. So, but it's kind of good because so innovation suffered at the time maybe a little bit because there was no, you know, people weren't just writing blank checks for a piece of paper or napkin that said, here's your business plan, I'm going to sell pet food online. Woo, you know, like, oh, that's brilliant. Okay. I love the one, what was it, Webvan or something, where they would deliver anything, you know, from a drugstore or supermarket to your door, but they weren't charging enough for the delivery, and of course the company went out of business. It's pretty simple economics there. But it's good because it brings us back to, you know, a grounding, a foundation, a saying, well, what's important? Why are people using the Internet? Are they just using it for commerce and, you know, buying stuff? Of course not. You know, people are using the Internet to connect with other people. And that leads us to the next great big, you know, innovation, just not on the Internet, but also for mental health, which is the beginnings of social networking. And social networking is simply allowing people to connect more easily with one another in methods not otherwise readily available. So, of course, you can connect with a researcher if you're a researcher at one university, and you can email that other researcher. But social networking lets you do that without actually knowing that another researcher exists. And that's one of the keys, is that based upon like interests and characteristics that you choose, you can find other people with those kinds of like interests and whatnot. So early social networks, Friendster, no one knows or remembers because it was in 2002. and MySpace started in 2004. It's, you know, going downhill here. Social networking becomes not only more accessible and easier, but much more complex and able to span out across different parts of the world to bring people together regardless of location or distance. We could be doing this in a kind of social networking format, and maybe we can continue the conversation that we begin here today in that kind of format on Twitter, other ways of connecting with each other. And of course, social networking was not surprisingly initially embraced by younger people who instantly saw, hey, wow, this lets me find like new music and new bands. So maybe not the most mental health oriented things, but it paves the way for that kind of thing. So you look at some of the things, and that's just a really fast 15-year walkthrough, but it really brings us up to today, more or less. And you look at some of the things that that the past 15 years we've accomplished on the internet with all these great technologies. And one of them is that the stigma of mental health concerns, I think today, is significantly reduced from 15, 20 years ago. It's still out there, and it's, I think, very societal dependent, depending upon different countries and societies. But in general, I think the internet has been a big boon to helping people understand that this is not a character flaw, this is not just something that you can, you know, decide to make a change in your head about it. The usage of educational support resources on the internet continues to climb. This graph is a graph of our traffic on Psych Central, for instance, just for the past year. It's nearly doubled in 1 year. More professionals taking an active role in providing care. We'll talk about that in a minute. Of course, researchers have been using the online tools and studying more online services and behaviors. And there's more customized interventions being offered or being proposed to be offered, providing a therapeutic intervention or information exactly what's needed, and that's called, there's a term and an organization surrounding that called information therapy. And of course, data is increasingly being collected and analyzed in real time. It's amazing when you think about the 1.0 way of doing research. I hate to say it, is that you run an experiment, you collect your data, you spend months analyzing the data, and writing up the results, you submit the thing to the publication, 3-4 journals. 6 months later, they say, okay, we'll publish your paper, it'll come out in a year. And now what people are doing, which we'll talk about a little bit, is that you can collect, of course, real-time data. You can collect data from real patients out there. And while that may not give you the same kind of results that you can make broad generalizations about for a population, you can make individual decisions based upon some of that data, which we'll talk about in a minute. According to the Pew Internet American Life Project, this is how health online today is being used. Most people are searching for health concern, specific condition like depression or anxiety or ADHD. They're searching for prescription information. As of December 2008, 83% of all internet users have searched online for health information. That means we've long since crossed over the majority threshold, and you can, 8 out of 10 people have actually already used the internet to look up some health information. And 61% of U.S. adults have searched for health online health information. You'll see that also the trends are positive for the continued use of the internet for looking for mental health information and services on the internet. That print, television, radio, these traditional media that people get their information from, are all likely to decline over the next couple years. This report came out in 2006. So basically what happens is that more people plan to use the internet more often, and that's not surprising because you continue to have the younger generation age, and as they age, they have health concerns. And as they have health concerns, where are they going to turn? The thing that they've always turned to for learning about something new, the internet. So the social networks today don't really quite look like the social networks of yesterday. They are constantly changing and constantly adding new features and applications and things. Web 2.0 is just a term that refers to the perceived second generation of web development. It's designed to facilitate communication and information sharing and collaboration on the web. It's funny because you have to throw that word perceived second generation because a lot of the tools that people identify as Web 2.0 are actually things that have been around for some time, like blogs. But they have led to the development and evolution of web-based communities, things like Facebook. I mean, Facebook a couple years ago was really nothing what it looks like today. You can do so many different things on Facebook with the applications. A lot of them are for fun. You know, you can poke someone. You can, you know, give them a virtual beer or something. But there's also an emerging area of health applications on Facebook that people are using to track their health condition, to take a screening quiz, for instance. 29% of internet users use social networking websites now. So if you think it's just a passing fad, it's not. It's not likely to be a passing fad. And although that's still not a majority, I think you'll find that that number is going to hit the majority within the next couple of years. Because once you look at the number of users under 30 who use social networking sites, it's over 50%. The service like Twitter, which allows you to, they call it a microblogging service because you can post a little tiny update about what you're doing, 140 characters, is less popular. Only 11% of internet users have used something like Twitter. But again, once you look at people under 30, you find that that number, again, almost doubles to 20%. So you find that people, that the social networks have definitely entered the mainstream, that they're not just for college students or teenagers anymore, and that adults are using them for all sorts of things as well. Which leads us to, you know, the next evolution, the next generation of applications online, which has gone under the term Health 2.0. Of course, we're mental health, so I guess we have to be Mental Health 2.0. But it basically refers to using social networking technologies and things like that to enable better health and mental health care. That you can use a very targeted set of these technologies to really help people improve their mental health. So I thought it would be helpful to quickly walk through some of these to give you an example of how these are being used. For instance, Patients Like Me is a website. It focuses on a number of different conditions right now. It includes mental health conditions. I'm going to note a muscular MS example here. What this patient found out was what Patients Like Me does is it encourages the people who sign up to basically input all of their data about the medications they're taking, to take regular screening tests or quizzes on the website that gives updates as to you know, their condition in terms of for the mental health mood disorders that they track. It be things like depression, anxiety, those kinds of quick screening quizzes. And then it tracks their progress as they change medications, as they up their dose. How does that affect their BDI score or something like that? Which seems like, okay, well, that sounds like an experiment. It basically is. It's a single case experimental design for each individual. But what also happens is suddenly you have a population of 1, 2, 50, 500, 5,000, 50,000 depressed patients who are taking Prozac, and suddenly you know more about how people actually are taking Prozac in the real world than the makers of Prozac, than the FDA, than anyone else in the world. Because although it's not as, you know, scientific or as well controlled as a clinical trial, it does have a lot of that real world data that can give you insights into, you know, what is an effective dose for a medication. So what this person found out was that they were not on a dose for their medication that would help them with their stiffness and spasticity. And once they found out that most people who were taking that medication were on a much higher dose and it actually helped them with that specific symptom, he was able to go talk to his doctor and say, hey, you know, can we increase my dose? And boom, his symptoms decreased. Here's in the HIV form, a patient took a drug holiday, and that's when you stop all your medications, because sometimes you're taking so many medications, especially with the early days of HIV, it was you didn't know what was causing what symptom, quite frankly. At the end, you had so many symptoms that were non-HIV related but were medication related and dose related. But he instantly found out that after he stopped all his medications, his virus load spiked up to 7,000, which is very bad. So he started adding the medications back. For him, a drug holiday was not a good thing. For some patients, it can be helpful. But he also was able to cut down the number of medications he was taking by doing that and working with his doctor with this data. That this data, all that you could do by, you know, you could easily do without having a website to do it for you, people don't do because it's not easy. It doesn't give you a clear indication like like this graph does of what's going on. Another website called medhelp.org is really a simple place. It's just sort of a community website where professionals go on and answer questions posted to the community. And they do this, I guess, out of a feeling of helping out in a direct manner with people that they have questions with. But a lot of times, you know, people wonder why, you know, a thing like e-therapy service isn't as popular as maybe it should be. Why aren't more people doing online counseling? Or lots of people are doing it, but not a lot of consumers are engaging in it. Well, it's hard to compete with free. I mean, that's one of the core tenets of the internet, is that if you have two services, and although they're not the same, I mean, you can't say advice on a free website is the same as a counseling session online. They're similar enough in many consumers' minds that if I can go and get some advice and then ask a follow-up question or two, maybe that's all I really needed. I really didn't maybe need a full-blown counseling session. And there's so many misconceptions about therapy to begin with that maybe people don't always understand the difference between the two. So this is really taking the community and being able to leverage it in a way that people find can find other people that they're similar to in the depression community, for instance, and then get questions answered by professionals who go there. Cure Together is another brand new Health 2.0 website. Very similar, patients like me, not as detail-oriented in the kind of data that they're collecting. So you get these treatment statistics for depression is based upon the community of members at Cure Together. And you find things like, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is, I can't read that. has an average effectiveness of 3.9. Anything over 3 on their scale is good. And that's fine. But cognitive behavioral therapy as a treatment is not like taking Prozac. I mean, it definitely varies widely based upon the professional you go see and how they've been trained in it and how they actually practice it. So these kinds of sites, I think, are interesting. I'm not sure we've reached their potential yet because they do kind of just lump cognitive behavioral therapy in one big category, and they compare it to things like exercise, which is apparently just as effective as cognitive behavioral therapy. So instead of, you know, treating people for depression with cognitive behavioral therapy, we should definitely be saying, hey, maybe you should exercise too. I don't know. And then our community, Psych Central, I have to throw in there too. We have 100,000 members. We also do ratings of things like drugs. So we ask people who've taken a specific drug like Klonopin or Celexa or whatever, you know, how are you doing on this drug? What kind of dose level are you taking it? And then we can create these pretty graphs that show how many people are taking it and what they think of it rating-wise. We also have something. We have 2 dozen screening quizzes on our website, and we allow people to save those screening quiz results. So, like, if you take a depression screening quiz, you can actually take it every week while you're in treatment, and you get these pretty graphs here in the middle that can show you how you're doing as time progresses, whether you're doing better or worse or whatnot. So what's been one of the effects of all this great new technology and access to information? Because it's one thing to just put it all out there and hope that people make use of it. But, you know, what do people do with it? One of the sort of side effects of having the Internet come so far as it has in the past 15 years is something called an e-patients movement, which is really people who have conditions. And this has certainly been more popular in health, where the gatekeeping function of health conditions, especially serious health conditions like a cancer diagnosis, is really in the hands of a specialist who's supposed to know everything about that condition. What you find out, though, is that a lot of specialists, even though they're specialists, don't know everything. And, of course, as any client or patient can tell you, that you can't necessarily be an expert in everything, especially if you're a generalist. And surprisingly, even if you're a specialist, that in medicine more so than maybe mental health, it's very challenging to keep up with the research literature. That both the Medline and the PsycINFO databases in just the past 10 years have doubled in the number of entries that they have. So when you have a research database that has 200,000 new entries being made every year, how can you keep up with all that research? How can you go and take a continuing education course and learn that new technique and still do your practice and still do this and that and the other thing? Well, e-patients have kind of figured that out. It was started by the late Dr. Tom Ferguson. And it's just about sort of empowering people to learn more about their condition, and instead of just being this docile person who sits there and says, okay, we're going to run this test, and we're going to do this, and this is the treatment we recommend, they actually take charge of their own treatment and healthcare and become an equal partner with their doctor or a therapist. And if you want to learn more about that, I encourage you to read the white paper at epatients.net. Oh, you gotta love Twitter. I've got a few minutes left here. I'm just gonna quickly mention Twitter. 140 characters. It's basically like a public conversation is the best way to, because once you start following more than like 100 people, there's no way you can sort of keep up with it. It's not like email. It's a conversation that's going on between 100 or 200 or 300 people, however many people you're following. And in the program I use, it just kind of flows on the screen to the right of what I'm doing. People really haven't figured out what it's for. You know, it's one of those technologies that allows social interaction to occur on the internet, and that's really a popular thing. That's why people spend so much time on the internet. World of Warcraft is not popular because it's a great video game. It's an okay video game. It's popular because you're not just interacting with a computer, you're interacting with the other people you're playing against. Second Life, great virtual environment that people are doing really wild and interesting things in, including online therapy as an environment. Again, it's not just because it's a virtual world, it's because it's a virtual world populated by other people. And at the end of the day, that's really what people, why people make a service popular is because of the social connections that they make. I also mentioned that I don't really want, have time to get into Twitter. You know, the rise of the mobile cell phone is just amazing too. I mean, iPhone and the Blackberries have really taken the internet now from being just a computer-based phenomena to taking it that you can take the internet with you wherever you go. So, one of the interesting things going on also seemed relevant to this conference was this thing called the Online Mental Health Action Committee, which is really an effort to provide internet-based mental health-focused disaster relief services to people in need of affected disaster areas. This got started after the Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans in 2005. And it's really picked up steam in the past 2 years where they have put together an organization. I have some brochures if you want to learn more about it. Basically, the goal there is to provide disaster relief services through internet counseling with therapists, you know, stationed all over the world. You don't have to bring all these resources down to the disaster area. You can make use of existing community and public health resources where they have computers and whatnot. Of course, professional networks have grown since 1994. You have this social networking website called CIRMO for physicians. But I find that a lot of the professional networking and communication really seems to still be going on a lot of mailing lists and places like LinkedIn and whatnot. So you also have professional tools like Global Mind Screen, which is a basically the equivalent of an intake quiz that you can have your patients fill out, your clients fill out before they ever see you for that first session, and so you get a nice generated report at the end when they're done filling it out, which kind of gives you a lot of that same kind of information gathering, because you know the first session is always so often just a fact gathering process in very one way, and you know, it's perfect for a computer to take over a lot of that, and then you can focus on, you know, interacting more with the patient there and spend more time with the client when they're in your office. And I couldn't not talk about internet addiction. You can't mention 15 years of mental health online without the infamous 1996 APA presentation by Kimberly Young. But the problem with this concept, which I've said since day one, is that you can really apply overuse, behavioral overuse of anything to anything, that there's nothing unique about the internet, that you couldn't make a similar argument, or that people made similar arguments back in when television came on the scene, when the telephone was invented. If you look in history, there were a lot of people who were very upset about the TV and video games, et cetera, et cetera. So recent analysis show that the research, I mean, there's been so many studies published on this phenomena, and yet they are all so flawed. So I just needed to mention that. You can look up some of those references if you'd like to. If it's in the DSM-5, I can only imagine it'll be in the categories needing further research. So final slide. And then we get coffee. We've come such a long way in such a short time. Internet time is so compressed that 2 years on the internet is like forever. But in real life, it feels like forever that 15 years has actually occurred. The there have been fundamental changes to the way we communicate, not just with strangers or colleagues. Most people don't use Facebook to get a whole bunch of friends that they don't know. They use it to communicate with their existing network of friends and family. So instead of having to send an email or actually pick up the phone to keep everybody updated on my life, I don't live around my family, I can update my Facebook status or update my Twitter status. It really just adds a whole nother level of communication to our lives. And the next 15 years are likely to bring about changes that that we haven't even dreamed about. I mean, if 15 years ago, if you would have told me that any of what we're doing today is possible, I would have looked at you like you're crazy. But 15 years has brought us these powerful tools that are available anywhere, anytime, to anyone. That they have opened up these communication avenues that we could not have imagined 15 years ago. And 15 years from now, I can't imagine what it's going to look like. So I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much.
I will now be...